Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, September 25th, 2021. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 7 to 8 Eastern Standard Time, right here on WLIW 88.3 FM and online at wliw.org/radio. And as you know, each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. That's annliguori.com. And distributed via podcast. And segments of the show are distributed on Morning Read and sportsillustrated.com/golf each week. Well, I am at Whistling Straits on the shores of Lake Michigan in Wisconsin. It's about an hour north of Milwaukee, and the drive here, it's actually beautiful, featuring just stunning farmland. The state is one of the nation's leading dairy producers, particularly famous for its cheese, of course. As you know, the cheese heads are everywhere when you talk about the Green Bay Packers, and they've been plentiful here. The cheese heads, the hats, have been all over here at the Ryder Cup. In fact, the European team has had a great time walking out to the practice rounds with the cheese head hats and throwing them into the crowd. It really is a fun touch, so it's been fun to see, and the kids are loving it. Whistling Straits is one of two 36-hole links-style golf courses, a luxury resort located near Sheboygan, Wisconsin. It is owned by the Kohler Company. In fact, there is a huge Kohler showroom right near the hotel on the resort property. Beautiful resort. The other course here is Black Wolf Run. And, you know, Whistling Straits reminds me of an Irish Lynx course. It's open. It's rugged. There's lots of wind. It's along 2 miles on the Lake Michigan shoreline. So you do get weather and you do get wind. And I have to say the Ryder Cup is probably my favorite sporting competition, even more so than the Olympics. And I've covered many winter games and summer games. But ever since first covering this biennial pressure-packed competition between the U.S. and Europe, my first Ryder Cup was back in 1999, the Battle of Brookline in Massachusetts. You know, there's nothing quite like the drama and all the compelling stories that we get every day of Ryder Cup week. And there's just so much pressure for these players, and you just love the team aspect of it. And obviously the American patriotism comes out on American soil and overseas, and the European fans are just intense and excited. So it just makes for just an incredible week. And USA captain Steve Stricker has utilized the pod system again this year, which Paul Azinger first used when he captained the U.S. team in 2008. And it worked to lead that U.S. team to their first win back then since 1999, as the unity of the four-man pod system matched the unity that the European team seemed to display every time they play a Ryder Cup. Players are put together in the four-man pods. They're teamed together based on their chemistry and their similarities and how they feel they will enjoy playing with each other. It worked for the U.S., you know, back in 2008. But obviously nothing can replace the fun-loving, the seemingly relaxed style of the European team and the way they enjoy being together, the way they bond with each other. They are really team players. The U.S. team gets a bad rap a lot about the fact that they're more individual, they're more independent, they're more about themselves individually than they are about the team. Certainly the chemistry on the European team seems to be the intangible that has worked for Europe. And another thing is they also put Ryder Cup victories ahead of major titles for the most part in terms of importance. To the Europeans, winning the Ryder Cup is really, really important, more so in most cases than individual victories. And maybe that's a reason why Europe has won 9 of the last 12 Ryder Cups, even if 4 of those 9 were only won by a 1-point margin. Now, the Americans lost badly in Paris a couple years ago, 2018. 17.5 to 10.5, the Europeans won. And it was an interesting Ryder Cup. The course seemed more kind of American. The Parisians really didn't care much about the Ryder Cup, didn't know much about it. They're not big on golf, but the European team went out there and just dominated. The last time the Ryder Cup was on American soil, the U.S. did win, and that was back at Hazeltine in 2016 in Minnesota, 17-11, the American win, and they dominated that year. But the American team has only won twice in the last 20 years, in 2008 and 2016. Now, the American team has 8 of the top 10 players in the world rankings. John Rahm, the top-ranked male golfer, is the only European player in the top 10. But you can, you know, point out these records and point out various opinions on what, you know, makes a team, chemistry and patriotism, et cetera, et cetera. But the games are all won on the course, of course. And we're no doubt in for a most exciting weekend. This morning, golf historian Martin Davis will join me. Martin published a beautiful coffee table book that took about 6 years to produce called The Ryder Cup, Golf's Grandest Event, A Complete History. And it certainly is. We talk about the history of the Ryder Cup, and Martin actually uncovers, with all the research they did about the book, uncovers two facts that have been wrong all these years when it comes to Ryder Cup history. First up, the American team sported blue Delta jeans this past Wednesday at a team dinner. We'll hear all about this all-American company with their senior VP of sales, Blake Kochenour. Hope you enjoy this special Ryder Cup edition of Sports Interview. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Blake Kochenour, the Senior VP of Sales at Blue Delta Jeans. How are you, Blake?
I'm mighty fine. How are you this morning?
Good to talk to you. And Blue Delta Jeans are the official jeans of the U.S. Ryder Cup team, who obviously are in Whistling Straits this week for the Ryder Cup. And wow, I can see these guys wearing your Blue Delta jeans. They're going to be styling.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, absolutely. So we, Blue Delta, we're a small custom jean manufacturer based down in Tupelo, Mississippi. And, you know, we make a custom garment, 16 measurements, you know, unlimited fit and customization options. And so we've had a long run over the last couple of years working with a lot of professional athletics, and had the opportunity a couple of years back to be made an official team supplier for Team USA. And, you know, putting our brand next to Ralph Lauren and the Ryder Cup logo was something we were more than happy to take on. So yeah, the guys will all be wearing our jeans up at Whistling Straits this week and you know, making us look good.
So I love the fact that you are a USA company, manufactured in Tupelo, Mississippi. Your storefront is in Oxford, Mississippi, where Ole Miss is located. I had a wonderful time going to an Ole Miss game a couple of years ago, and just really walking around Oxford, Mississippi. It's just a beautiful town. And the fact that the craftsmanship is it's all right here in good US of A, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, absolutely. So we make every single jean. We don't make a rack garment. Everything we do is custom. But we make all of our jeans in our shop here in Tupelo. And so, you know, it is a true US made garment. And you know, that and the Team USA partnership, we're obviously very proud of to put a U.S. made garment on the U.S. team as they you know, battle it out up in Wisconsin.
So how did Blue Delta Jeans connect with the PGA?
Yeah, so you know, I mentioned we did a lot of work in Major League Baseball and the NFL, and you know, just kind of in those circles, we were introduced to Pete Bevecqua, who is the CEO of the PGA at the time. It's been a couple years back, but he's been a great supporter of ours. And, you know, he's at NBC now, but he carved out a little niche for us. And Ralph Lauren handles all the on the course wear for the team. But, you know, Pete helped us get in, and we've had a lot of good people treat us really well along the way. And so, yeah, that was how that developed. You know, nothing's more American than a pair of blue jeans. And, you know, with having the Ryder Cup stateside this go around, it just made a natural fit.
So when did you fit the players?
Well, we were lucky. So at the PGA Championship this year, the PGA had us come in, the top 25 US players at the time. I was lucky enough to set up in the dive boardroom or the upstairs, the Kiowa clubhouse, the ocean course, for 3 days. And those guys over the course of those 3 days came in at their leisure. They had me there. They had a tailor from Ralph Lauren and the folks from New Era who were doing the hats for the team. We got to fit and size everybody for the jeans. And then as the last couple of weeks have rolled and the captain's picks and the six automatic qualifiers, and then of course the last couple of captains getting Phil Mickelson and Fred Couples in there, we were, you know, we've got all their measurements. And so as the team got picked, we just started putting those jeans into production for them.
So did the top 25 get the jeans or just the Ryder Cup team?
Well, you know, we had the opportunity to make jeans for the best 25 US players out there. So we took the opportunity.
That's awesome.
You know what I'm saying? It is kind of funny. We, like I said, we've been working with PGA for a couple of years now. We do gifting at a lot of PGA events. And so it was, you know, we were fortunate that top 25, we already had 14 of them in jeans. So I got to make some jeans ahead of time. And when Justin Thomas or Dustin Johnson or some of those guys came in, it was, hey, here's a new pair of jeans for you. Try them on, make sure you still like them. And we were good to go.
So what has been the feedback from some of the players?
It's been really good so far. You know, they are in a world where it's a lot of golf clothing. They're very accustomed to, you know, synthetic stretch materials and dry fit shirts and whatever it may be. And so to have a unique new garment, something for them to wear, and especially like you mentioned, that's a US made garment. It's been really, really good feedback so far. You know, Captain Stricker, he's been a good supporter of ours for a couple of years and has made this a really easy and fun process to do.
So will they be wearing blue jeans or, I mean, I know you have a variety on your website. What jeans will they be sporting during the dinner on Wednesday of Ryder Cup week?
So we, as you mentioned, bluedeltajeans.com, you can go on there. We've got, depending on the time of year, somewhere between 30 and 40 fabrics that we offer and about 18 thread colors, fits and styles and all those customization options. But we do have a Ryder Cup branded jean. It's one of our classic dark indigo dyes. And then some of the customization touches on the watch pocket, on the right front pocket, we've got the Ryder Cup trophy monogrammed. And then the pocket linings for all of the jeans have the Team USA shield. So they'll have their own special edition jean that, of course, anyone here listening is welcome to go and snag a pair of as well on our website.
So what separates Blue Delta Jeans as far as the craftsmanship goes or style from other American companies, would you say?
Right. So, you know, everybody that makes a pair of jeans makes good jeans. I don't mean to disparage any other company or any other brand, but we do have a very unique way of making our jeans. You know, like I mentioned, we do either a traditional bespoke tailoring method where we take 16 measurements for men or women, or on our site there at bluedeltajeans.com, you can go on and we have a virtual tailor. So it's a short questionnaire. You get to, you know, dictate the style and the fit of your jeans and of course choose your fabric and all those customization pieces. Either way you do that, we've got a team of pattern makers in our shop there in Tupelo. Every single jean that we make is made on a personalized pattern. So there are no two jeans that are exactly the same. They're hand cut and sewn there. So, you know, you're talking about a pair of jeans that takes, you know, maybe three and a half hours to take from start to finish. Whereas your bigger box brands, the ones that everybody's familiar with, they're running fabric through machines and assembling a jean in 2 or 3 minutes. Right. So Again, everybody makes a good jean. They wouldn't be in an existing company if they didn't make a product. We're just particularly proud of the way that we do it and the quality that we offer.
Wow, so it takes how many hours per jean?
It takes a couple hours. There's a lot of handwork in each jean. Sure. It's a you know, a tender love and care process to get a pair of jeans put together.
And is the material pretty much the same as other companies, or is it a different material?
No, we do offer a slightly different material. You know, everything in the times that we live in has gone to having a little bit of stretch to it. And we have that little bit in ours as well, just a touch to give you a little bit of give and go. But we offer a middle weight denim. So about 9 to 10 ounces, it breathes well. You know, we're here in Mississippi, right? So we need something that breathes well in the summers, but yeah, a little bit of breathability, a little bit of stretch. And then of course it's custom tailored. So it's going to look good on you. It's going to feel good on you. And, being a bespoke garment like it is, you know, we've got people who get, you know, dark blue with dark blue stitching, and we've got people who order our, you know, our cranberry cotton chinos and put purple stitching on it. I mean, it's, it's a lot of variety going out the door in the shop there in Tupelo.
And I understand you've already heard from Freddie Couples when he got his pair.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. We just got a note this morning from Freddie. Apparently he is, obsessed was the word that we got. So I was very glad to get that this morning.
Freddie, one of the assistant captains. How about Phil? Phil likes to wear a good pair of jeans.
Yeah. Phil, you know, Phil's, he's a bit of a fashion icon, I guess you could say, but yeah, you know, he's got those big calves he's famous for. So we were, had to put a little bit of extra allowance around that part of the jeans to make sure he had enough room.
And what about Brooks Koepka? I could see him, roughing and toughing it, you know, with his, interesting personality in your jeans.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. You know, there, some of the guys on the team, you know, a little bit more slender builds, they're a little bit easier to fit. There's a couple on there that are, you know, maybe a little bit more height and a little bit more muscle, so that we had to put a little extra care on those, because those guys are particular about how they like their clothes to fit. But yeah, I mean, they're in a person that I don't feel confident making a pair of jeans for. So,
well, Bryson DeChambeau, obviously at one point he had built up so much muscle mass, but then he got COVID and it looked like he lost a lot of weight. Last I saw him in August. So how does that work when you measure them at the PJ Championship and their bodies may change?
Yeah, you know, we made a garment for everybody after the PGA and sent it out to them. And so we got some feedback on fit. And that was a question that I asked Bryson when I got to fit him originally was, hey, what's the diet and workout plan for the next 3 or 4 months? But no, they've been very good about giving us feedback and you know, making sure we've got them a pair of pants that they're going to enjoy wearing for a long time.
And all 12 players and the captain and the captain's assistants, they're all going to wear it when?
So they'll all be wearing our jeans on Wednesday night. That will be the 22nd. So they've got a big team dinner that night. That's the kickoff of the Ryder Cup. So, you know, it'll be Blue Delta jeans and Ralph Lauren sports jackets for the team that night.
Wow, that should be really sharp. And I know among the celebrities who have donned Blue Delta jeans are Morgan Freeman, Eli Manning, Tim Tebow, John Calipari, John Lester, Vince Gill. So you have, you guys get around.
We do. Yeah. We in the professional athletics world, you know, we've got a couple hundred Major League Baseball players, a couple 100, 200 guys in the NFL. You know, us being here in Mississippi, we've had a lot of professional athletes come out of the state. So you get a guy like Eli Manning that went to Ole Miss, or Dak Prescott, who's the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. He's a Mississippi State guy. And, you know, Mississippi is a small state, and we've been lucky enough to, you know, get connected to these athletes and be able to put them in our jeans. But yeah, Morgan Freeman, he's a native Mississippian. He lives just down the road from us and has been a really good friend of the brand. And, you know, you take care of people and they'll introduce you to their friends. And that doesn't matter if you're a, you know, an Emmy Award winning musician or, you know, winning Grammys or whatever it may be. You know, you have something you enjoy, you're going to tell your friends about it. And then we take care of everybody.
And Blake, what's the connection with Blue Delta Jeans and Oxford, Mississippi?
Yeah, so our two founders, Josh West and Nick Weaver, they're both native Mississippians, childhood friends. Josh is a Tupelo guy. And so that's why our factory is over there. In addition to, you know, Tupelo just having a ton of sewing talent in the garment and furniture manufacturing. Nick Weaver, one of our other owners, he's an Oxford guy. And so back in 2014, we were, you know, a young company at the time and needed to open a storefront so that we could, you know, sell more jeans. And Oxford is, you know, a unique little town for the state of Mississippi. But Oxford may be one of the very few towns in the state where we could sell, you know, a more expensive custom garment. And the city of Oxford's been incredibly good to us. So, but between Tupelo and Oxford, we've got a lot of folks wearing our jeans and are, you know, awfully proud of the support we've gotten over the years from those folks.
I have to put you on the spot now. So who are you picking? I know the last Ryder Cup, I was there in Paris, the European team beat the Americans. So the American team has a lot to prove this time around at Whistling Straits. Who are you picking?
Miss Ann, you're putting me on the spot. Of course, I'm going to have to say, you know, the boys in Blue Delta are going to have to be my pick. But I think it's going to be a good Ryder Cup. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. It's a unique course and setup. We got to go up there a couple of years ago for a corporate event we did, and you know, it ate my lunch that day. Now I'm no professional golfer, but yeah, it's a tough course. Hopefully the long drivers can get themselves close and wedge it in and finish it out. I don't know. We'll see. That's why we watch.
We'll see if the wind picks up, which it should be right on the water there. Those Europeans know how to play in those conditions, right? Bad weather, a lot of wind.
They do.
Thanks so much, Blake Kochenour, the Senior VP of Sales for Blue Delta Jeans. Enjoy the Ryder Cup, Blake. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, and I am at the Ryder Cup Whistling Straits, and my guest is golf historian Martin Davis, who has come out with his 39th book, The Ryder Cup, Golf's Grandest Event, A Complete History. Congratulations, Martin. Another incredible achievement.
Thank you very much, Ann. It took us 6.5 years to do.
I remember when you told me you were working on it, and it's a coffee table book full of just incredible photographs and essays from top golf writers and really legends in the game. Forwards by Jack Nicklaus, Tony Jacklin, John Feinstein wrote the introduction. You'll talk a little bit about it, but first, how much does it weigh? Because I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get it back to New York.
It weighs 9.5 pounds. So the joke is when I do a book signing, I tell people if you get tired of reading it, you can stop and work out for a while with it.
I know. It's definitely a book that you can do arm weights with. But anyway, you've also published the Hogan Mystique, The Legend of Bobby Jones, and gosh, 39 books. It really took you 6 years to complete this?
More than 6 years, yeah. It took. I was doing other things during that time. But and they were, I really, for the last couple of years, I had somebody working full time that I was an associate editor working on it as well.
So it must feel like just a huge achievement when it's actually published and it looks as gorgeous as it does.
You know, I had put it down and I hadn't looked at it for a little while. And we're here at the Ryder Cup and everybody was talking about it. And I went, holy mackerel, this was a lot of work. And it's really complete because I was trying to refresh my memory for some of the stories and some of the research that we did. And I'm just amazed at how complete it is. And we actually broke some new news, if you can break some new news on historical things. But we did on a couple of factors.
You'll have to tell me what some of those news bulletins are. But you have been in Whistling Straits for a while now doing book signings in the merchandise tent, correct?
Yeah. The merchandise tent this afternoon, it's been here for 3 or 4 days and we've been signing books. But the merchandise, it was so, I don't want to say overrun, but it was like a mob scene. and the checkout line like wrapped around the place, and it was right by where we were signing books, and we just ran out of books this afternoon. So, and the Ryder Cup hasn't started yet.
Well, that's a good thing. I think golfers truly appreciate the history of golf, particularly the Ryder Cup, and in the title, the Ryder Cup, golf's grandest event, that a complete history. I wanted to ask you first, why do you think the Ryder Cup is golf's grandest event?
There's no other event in golf like it. The Masters is wonderful, but it's very well. You've been there a lot, Ann. It's very respectful. It's a little staid, but it's terrific, and a lot of history and a lot of tradition. The U.S. Open can be a little more boisterous, but there's nothing like the Ryder Cup. It's I consider it a combination of World Cup soccer with all the singing and chanting and costumes and all of that, and NASCAR with its wrecks, you know, with its car wrecks, and a little bit of Yankees Red Sox rivalry, and it's just when you go there, I mean, there will be 40,000 people a day. And remember, morning and afternoon on the first 2 days, there are only four matches, four in the morning and four in the afternoon. You can't put 10,000 people on a hole in golf. So there are the jumbotrons up, and the Europeans come in costumes. I mean, people, you've been there. I mean, it's hysterical. And then they start the ole, ole, ole chants, and it couldn't be better. And it can only happen every two. You couldn't do it every year. But every 2 years, and it's every fourth year in your own country, and when it's in on your side, when it's in America or when it's in Europe, there's an advantage. There's that home team. You know, you're the home team. There's a big advantage there.
Absolutely, and I want you to know I've covered every Ryder Cup since Brookline, so that's going back a long time. A lot of Ryder Cups on American soil, overseas, on European soil. So I agree with you. The Ryder Cup is golf's grandest event. There's nothing quite like that excitement, particularly in golf. Now, I've covered many Olympics, Winter Games and Summer Games, but the Ryder Cup, it's just so exciting.
And you know, it is, but I've seen the growth of it, but, you know, by the 60s, even into the 50s and 60s and 70s, there wasn't a whole lot of interest in the Ryder Cup. I mean, people would go see it, and it was nothing like it is now. But it wasn't until Nicklaus came along in the late 70s with the suggestion of saying, people are losing interest in this, and he went to Lord Brabazon, who was the head of the European PGA, or the British PGA at the time it was called, and they asked him, Jack asked him, to include the Europeans. Well, you remember who the Europeans were, Seve. I mean, you don't have to say go much further than that. And then we had the great influx of, you had Langer, and you had Molinari, and you're getting, you know, from the other countries. So it became very competitive. But it really took off in 87 when it was at Muirfield Village at Jack's place, and Tony Jacklin beat Jack. And it was the first time that the Europeans ever, since the beginning of the Ryder Cup in the mid-20s, had ever beaten America on our soil. And that really kind of opened up. I mean, when it started in the early 80s and the Europeans came in, and you could see it coming. But the dam broke in 87, and it's never been the same.
That certainly was the modern Ryder Cup birth, right, in 1987, when Europe won the matches on Nicklaus's Muirfield Village, and the European team were dancing on the 18th green. What an insult to the American team and to Jack Nicklaus.
Oh, it was. You know, yeah, you had to be happy for them. I mean, it was sad that we lost, but it was terrific to see Tony Jacklin, who was their great player for a long time. He had won the U.S. Open. He had won the British Open. He was their best Ryder Cupper for a very long time, and it was a lot of fun. Wuzna was on I think he was on Faldo's shoulders. I mean, and the dancing and the partying, it was, and you know, at the end, and now it's kind of a tradition, with the big bottles of champagne and spraying the crowd with it. It's you wouldn't do that at the Masters.
No, you would do it in the Mets locker room, though. And I was part of Once Upon a Time in Queens, the documentary on the 1986 World Series winning Mets over the Boston Red Sox in game, you know, in game seven. And I was part of that documentary. And the first thing I think about when you say celebrating with champagne and pouring champagne over each other is I remembered Kevin Mitchell from the Mets pouring champagne all over me in the locker room. So that's just an aside. We'll get back to the Ryder Cup, golf's grandest event of complete history. But take us back to the very beginning of the Ryder Cup, Martin. When did it all start, and how did it start?
Okay. The first international match ever was 1913, and it was two Americans against two Frenchmen in France. And I hate to say it, but the French waxed us. I mean, it was they wiped us out. That was the first one. And there were a couple of preliminary ones. There was one in 1921. They were always tied in with, and in the early days of the Ryder Cup, tied in with the British Open, or the Open Championship. So 21, there was one in Glen Eagles, where you and I were several years ago. The common knowledge up until the time this book came out was that the Ryder Cup started in 1927, but it didn't. It actually started in 1926, and I'll be brief about it, but what happened was Ryder came up with this idea, and he was one of the very first people in the world to come up with the concept of sports marketing. He had this seed company where he would sell penny packets of seed through the mail. And the way you paid for your packets of seed, the Brits love, you know, their little gardens, was with postage stamps. And he went from living in a cold water flat in St. Albans, England, till 10 years later, he was the richest man in town and had a chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce. And he tied golf in with his company, and they would sponsor events. And so he had the concept for an international event. And so he went to Walter Hagen, and our great showman and player, and he said to the Hague, he said, you put together an American team. It was supposed to, originally it was 8 players, then they expanded it to 10, and finally I think to 12. But Hagen put together the team, and it was supposed to be played for the first time at Wentworth, and it was in England. And that was a couple of weeks before the Open Championship. As a matter of fact, Bobby Jones attended when he was trying to qualify at Sunningdale, which he did, and he was in the crowd. I mean, this great celebrity, that he was the best player in the world then. So, why don't they use the year 1926? It's a fascinating story.
It's one of those news flashes that you said you discovered just for this book.
Well, I'll tell you how it was. So, I mean, they kind of knew about it, and people used to just kind of slough it off. So we started to do the research on it. And there was something in England called the General Strike. 800,000 coal miners, I think that was the largest industry in Great Britain, went on strike. And all of the other labor unions in Britain struck in sympathy with the coal miners. Well, it shut down the whole country. So no one could get into the ports. And remember, travel then was you didn't get on a 767 at Kennedy Airport and fly over to Heathrow. It was by ship. And it was like 6 days. It was a 6-day transit. Half the American team got in. And there were other people already in the country to play in, from America, to play in the Open Championship. But those people were living in America, but they weren't Americans. Tommy Armour, who was Scottish, he was one of them. Long Jim Barnes, big tall guy, who won the first two PGA championships. He came in. So Hagen said, people like Johnny Farrell, who was one of the best players in the world at the time, Sarrazin couldn't get in. So about half the American team couldn't get in. So we played, and we were beaten, I think it was 10-6, by the Brits in that first Ryder Cup. Now, we looked at what you would call 9 pieces of measured media. And I'll give you a couple. The New York Times, the Herald Tribune, the Times of London, the Sunday Times. There was a golfing magazine over there. The Associated Press all had newspaper articles that we found and printed in the book that called it the Ryder Cup. It said the Ryder Cup was coming. But Ryder decided not to give out the trophy because he didn't think it was fair to the Americans because we didn't have a properly constituted team of all Americans because our whole team couldn't get in. So we refer to it in the book as the Ryder Cup that never was, but it was the first Ryder Cup. So the first official Ryder Cup was the next year, and it was at Worcester Country Club in Worcester, Mass., and it was 2-3 weeks before the U.S. Open at Oakmont, which, incidentally, Tommy Armour won that one. So that was the first thing that it's firmly established that the first Ryder Cup was in 1926, but they didn't give out the trophy, so they don't call it the first official one. The second thing that we broke was there was a really nice story about the cup itself. And about the cup, there's an image on top of the cup that looks like a player by the name of Abe Mitchell. And Abe Mitchell was the best player in Britain in the middle 20s. And Ryder himself had hired Mitchell because to teach him how to play golf. And because Ryder's doctor, he was 50 years old, had never played golf, and the doctor said, you have to get exercise, go play golf. So he hired this terrific player, and he had two jobs, to teach Ryder 6 days a week how to play golf, okay? But they were very religious, so never on Sunday, so they didn't play. So it was 6 days a week. And his other job was to practice hard to try to win the British Open, which he never did. But he was acknowledged as the best player in Britain. So the feel-good romantic story always was that the image on top of the cup when they made it was Abe Mitchell. And it looks a little like, it looks very much like him. But we did a lot of research, and we went back to the people that made the cup originally, found the build sheets, found the assay office documents when the cup was made, which again confirmed that the first, it was ready in 26, not in 27, that we found out that it confirmed the story about the first Ryder Cup.
Where are these documents?
There's a company called Mappin & Webb, which is still in existence. And they're the retailer and they were the manufacturer of the cup. But the documents are in England, and they're in the Sheffield, England assay office. You know on your grandmother's silverware where it has those stamped little letters? Well, that tells a story. And it told us the story of who these people were and who manufactured the cup, when it was manufactured, what the gold content was, all these tiny little letters, and there's a little key to it that you can read. And we went back, and there's pictures of, I sent somebody over there, somebody who was in England, and he went up to Sheffield, and he found when they checked out the Ryder Cup when it was built, just to verify that. And if you look at the Ryder Cup today, you'll see there's this little stamping, and it has M&W, which means Mappin & Webb, who is the manufacturer, and then it says 26 on it, which again confirms that it was made for the 26 Ryder Cup.
It was originally U.S. versus Britain.
Great Britain. Yeah, the United Kingdom. And then in late, mid-70s is when Nicholas had the concept of saying, hey, I think we have something here, but we really should put a little more juice into it, make it a little more exciting and more competitive. Well, it's a little too competitive because we haven't won everything anymore. But it used to be, for many, many years, it was like, our guys would get fitted with these nice blazers and clothes, and they'd go out and play golf for a couple of days and then take the trophy home. And it was, we just rolled over them. I think it was in 57, it was an aberration at Lindrick in the UK. We lost that. And to this day, nobody can figure out how we lost. I mean, we just so dominated golf that it was a foregone conclusion. But then when they started to include Seve and Molinari and a lot of course, Ola Thabo, and the great team was Seve and Ollie, you know, playing. I mean, you just think of years later, think of it 99 at the Country Club when Leonard made the putt, he was playing against Ola Thabo, you know.
That was huge. Yeah. And it his career has just skyrocketed since as a commentator. I so enjoy listening to Leonard. Let's get back to Seve Ballesteros. He, when you think of Ryder Cup, you know, you think of Seve and the fire and, you know, the gamesmanship and just winning at all cost. What made Seve so incredible as a Ryder Cup star?
Seve was very, very, very competitive. That's an understatement. He just wanted to win. And he was a very proud Latin. I mean, he was the embodiment. I knew Seve pretty well. He was the embodiment of macho. I mean, he didn't want to have anybody outdrive him. He didn't want to have anybody outputt him. And he certainly didn't want these crazy Americans to beat him. And he was just a very proud, passionate. It was the passion that he had for this. And he may have taken it a little too far, but it was a lot of gamesmanship. You know, the original competitiveness in the Ryder Cup, where there were rivalries, the rivalries in golf started with the Ryder Cup. It started with George Duncan and Walter Hagen back in the 20s. I mean, there was a huge rivalry. But then Seve had the rivalry, remember, with Azinger. And remember, then later, Azinger had the rivalry with, you know, the head-to-head with Faldo. And then, as I always say, Montgomery had a rivalry with everybody. You know, nobody liked him. You know, I'm not even sure his own team liked him. But he was very competitive, too.
Martin, if you had to pinpoint the greatest Ryder Cup rivalry in all of history up to this point, what would you say? What rivalry is it?
I would probably say that it was a common knowledge or common belief would probably be Nicklaus and Jacklin with in the concession when he, you know, when Jack gave him the 2-foot putt. But my favorite,
something that Seve said he would never do, by the way.
Oh, and Sam Snead was, old Sam was the U.S. captain, the non-playing captain. And when Jack conceded the putt to Tony, it ended up in a tie. But since we had won the two years previously, we were going to retain the cup anyway. And it was just this great show of sportsmanship. But my favorite rivalry was Hogan and Henry Cotton. Back in 47, which was the first Ryder Cup after the war, there was a wonderful man by the name of Robert Hudson who literally saved the Ryder Cup, which is another story in the book. But he, and people have to get into it, but he paid for, the Brits didn't have any money. They couldn't afford to. The Ryder Cup was over. And he was on the PGA board, and he was a wealthy fruit packer out in Portland. And he said, if you bring the Ryder Cup to Portland, I'll pay for the British team. And he did for several Ryder Cups. I mean, he supported the Brits because they just didn't have any dough. But the rivalry, so in 47, it was at Portland. Ben Hogan was the playing captain. And on the eve of the Ryder Cup, now Henry Cotton was, for one era, was their best player. He was really a terrific player. He had won the Open Championship 3 times. I don't think he had ever seen Hogan play. So right on the eve of the Ryder Cup, he goes to the officials and says to them, I think the Americans are playing with illegal clubs, meaning the clubs that they were playing with. Remember the whole issue not too many years ago about the square grooves? It was the same thing. Well, what it really was that Cotton had never seen Hogan play. He had never seen anybody that could control a ball like that. And he looked at it and he said, must be illegal clubs. So the officials checked on the eve of the Ryder Cup, they spent the night and they checked all the American clubs and they found that they were all conforming. Okay. Fast forward, They go to Ganton in 49 in the UK. Hogan is now the U.S. captain again. This is right after the accident. He's wan and he's very thin and he didn't look real well and he couldn't play. But he was the American captain. He was well enough to become was the captain. So on the eve of the Ryder Cup, Mr. Hogan says to the officials, this is turnabout as fair play. He said, I think the Brits are playing with illegal clubs. So they checked the clubs, and they found that two or three of the players had illegal clubs. I'm not sure they knew about it. So the pro at Ganton spent all night filing down the faces of the clubs so that the clubs conformed. So that was another one of the great – I love that story. That was one of the great rivalries.
That's a great story. I love these stories, Martin. So going back to the book, you have the late, great Dave Anderson, who we were so friendly with, a board member from our Met Golf Writers Association. He talked about the all-time Ryder Cup teams. Talk about who he chose.
It was funny. I had Dave pick the American team, and I had John Hopkins from the Times of London, another good friend of ours. Hoppy picked the European team. Well, the European team is all the more current players because they didn't really get to be good until the last 20 or so years.
And then they've dominated, by the way. Yeah. The European team has dominated the American team in the last 20 years.
Yeah. Not quite like we dominated them, but they've been better than us. So our team is a lot of the old players. So of course it's Jack, it's Arnie, it's Tom Kite, Hale Irwin, Billy Casper, and then we made Ben Crenshaw the assistant captain. Hogan is the captain.
So it's a fantasy team Dave Anderson wrote about.
Yeah, so we put together our dream team. It was, and then we did this beautiful piece of artwork of the players, the caricatures. It was sort of a team picture that could never be taken because some of those people had died before a few of them were even born. But it was on the European side. It was just a fun. A fun thing. For example, Walter Hagen is on the team. He was the great showman. And Hagen was also a real, I don't want to use the word runaround, but I guess he was. But he was a bon vivant. So we have caricatured with Hagen with holding a martini, you know. So.
And when did Dave write this?
Oh, this book was in the works for, you know, 6.5 years. So, he had passed away, but it was pretty good. It was fun. And then we'd put other people. We put on the bottom row. I put some of the writers. I put Grantland Rice there. I even put Dave in there, or I had the artist do it. And they kind of snuck me in the corner for no reason. But I got my picture in there. I got on the team. Well, not on the team, but in the artwork.
On the fantasy. Team in the fantasy artwork. The best Ryder Cup team ever. Alex Miceli wrote about it. Who did he choose?
Well, the best Ryder Cup team ever, that's another interesting story about the Ryder Cup. It was 1981, and Dave Marr, who was was the Ryder Cup captain, he had won the Ryder Cup in 1965 at Ligonier in Pennsylvania.
And you had Ben Crenshaw on that team, Raymond Floyd, yep. Hale Irwin, Tom Kite, Bruce Litsky, Johnny Miller, Larry Nelson, Jack Nicklaus, Jerry Pate, Bill Rogers, Lee Trevino, and Tom Watson. And explain why that was the greatest Ryder Cup team ever, in your opinion, and I guess in Alex's opinion.
Well, I think this is more than opinion, because every player on that team had either won a major already or would go on to win a major. Most of the several of the players, multiple majors, except one player. And that player was probably better than half the team, but his way of playing on tour was he'd make enough money and he'd say, I'm going fishing. And that was Bruce Litsky, who passed away a few years ago. But Leakey was a terrific player, and He was the only person on the team that had never won a major. The one thing about the Ryder Cup is, and people will, I mean, when you see it on television, and, you know, and we're going to get out on the course a little bit, but we're going to watch it in the press room. We'll hear the sounds. We'll have the flavor of it. But you can only see it in the – you see it best on television. But it's the passion. It's the emotions that the players play with, and then everybody gets behind.
So we're here in Whistling Straits, and one of the things that I think is so fascinating, Padre Carrington came up with this idea. I don't know who, if he did it himself or, you know, if somebody helped Padre come up with this idea, but there have been 164 players in the Ryder Cup and what he, on the European side, and what he, I guess on both sides, right? And what he has done is he has put the numbers of every player on the bag. So I don't know if you saw this. You're probably you know, so busy in the merchandising tent, but he says, you know, obviously the numbers on the bags remind the players that they are in a select group. Oh. And, you know, so 164 players since 1927, and each player on the European team has the number that they are picked on their bag. Isn't that a fascinating bit of history as far as just reminding people how special it is to be on that team?
Oh, absolutely. But he should have started back in 1926.
We now know, but they don't know that yet. Yep. Until they read your book. Last question, Marty. Who are you picking? I'm going to put you on the spot.
Oh, come on. I'm an American, you know, the all-American boy. I think so. I hope we can do it. But I've heard so many stories about the players and when they come out on the first tee and they announce your name playing for your country. And it's playing for your country. And they say that, you know, people have played Masters, have won U.S. Opens, but there's not a feeling like playing being announced at the Ryder Cup, because you're on a team and it's not just you that's going to fail or win. You're playing for your it's likened to war. I mean, when they talk about people in a war, the first, you know, the overall thing is you're fighting for your country, but what you're really fighting for is the other people in the foxhole. And at the Ryder Cup, you've got 12 people in the foxhole with you, and a captain and a couple of assistant captains, and it's all on your shoulders, you know. And they say the pressure and the emotion on that first tee, it's the concept of cotton mouth. It's you can't swallow. I mean, Dave Marr told me once about that he couldn't swallow on the first tee when his name was announced. There's nothing like it. I mean, this is, you know, and it's just the one thing about the Ryder Cup is it's just pure fun. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not deadly. It is serious, but it's fun. And that's why it's the grandest event in the game.
Martin, it's always a pleasure. We can go on and on. We'll have to do a part two. Okay. But the coffee table book's called The Ryder Cup, Golf's Grandest Event, A Complete History. We'll see you out at Whistling Straits.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Thanks so much. My thanks to Martin Davis, to Blake Kokenauer, to Mike Goodsell in production, and Delaney Hefner in the studio. Enjoy the Ryder Cup wall-to-wall coverage today and Sunday on the Golf Channel and NBC. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be safe, be happy, and I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.